Just want y'all to know, if Priscilla comes up to you with a bag of dark chocolate M&Ms, she might want you to do something else later on. And this might be one of those things, so beware of Priscilla bearing gifts. That's all I have to say. And it was very sweet, and I ate them all, and they were delicious. They were very good. But thank you for thinking of me to do this again. Oh, I tell you, you know what? I should have said nothing. I should have said nothing last year at all about chocolate, but that's how it goes. All right, so I have giving, and man, I tell you what, when you talk about giving in the Bible, in your life as a Christian, there are so many rabbit holes that we could go down, right? It should permeate. It should be who you are. And you could, sorry. Undivided attention is not my thing. you give your time to those who are sick, to those who are in need, to those who need exhortation. You give your resources, you know, you invite people into your home. Maybe they don't have a home anymore, and you give that. You give your whole being in that. Just maybe bringing food to somebody. It is part of giving, and it should be who you are. But thankfully, we're discussing giving in worship, so your subject goes from here to about right there, right? So it still narrows it down. It helps us focus our subject. Okay, I need to apply giving in my worship to God. And when you start doing that, you start getting your scripture together, you get giving and worship, it does narrow it down just a little more. And like every lady who has come before me has already said, you have to keep in mind, in the Old Testament, you do have two different dispensations, right? You have the patriarchal, and you have the mosaical. And if anybody knows how to spell that, would somebody please tell me? Because on spell check, it was not working. You laugh because you know. All right? All right, so when we look at the word worship in the Old Testament, we talk about giving. There's a couple of words that would probably come to your mind, right? You have offering, you have vows, you have free will offerings. So there's a lot of words that come to mind. And the word worship in the Old Testament, it is shakah. It means to depress, prostrate, especially in homage to royalty or God. Bow self down, crouch, fall down flat, humbly beseech, do make obeisance, do reference, make to stoop worship. And when you see this word in the Old Testament, whether it's worship, worshipped, worshiper, worshipers, worshipeth, say that five times fast, it is always this definition or a form of this definition, except for one. And that's in Jeremiah 44:19. And from last year, I like words. They mean things. And so you should understand a word before you use it. And the words depress and obeisance were ones that really caught my eye. Depress means to repress, like bring down, subjugate. So when you think of subjugate, I'm making myself subject. I am meaning to make myself subject. I am willingly doing that, okay? I have decided to do what you've told me to do. This is what worship is. And then there's obeisance. It means to the acknowledgement of another's superiority or importance. So when you take all of those words and you bring them together, you understand worship, it involves action and it involves attitude. Okay? You can't have one without the other when you worship. And sometimes one will catch up with the other. And we understand that, especially as you grow as a Christian. But if I want to be complete, if I want to be perfect, I need to work really hard to make that attitude and action equal in my worship. So when I worship, I need to make sure they're both there. And like I said, Old Testament, there's a lot of ways you can describe giving. Offering, sacrifice, tenth, tithes, tribute, vows. And we're going to start in the book of Genesis like everybody else does. in Genesis chapter 4. I mean, it's amazing to me how you can have a section of scripture and each lady has something else to add to it. Okay, so let's go to Genesis chapter 4. We already know what's happening here. Genesis chapter 4, we're going to do verses 3 through 5. And in process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering unto the Lord. And Abel he also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof. And the Lord had respect unto Abel and to his offering. But unto Cain and to his offering he had not respect, and Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. So you see here in giving, it's described as an offering. It is from the Hebrew word mincha. It is from an unused root meaning to apportion, that is bestow, a donation, euphemistically tribute. Now that last one got me. Euphemistically tribute. I think we all know what a euphemism is, right? Euphemistically, it's a nice way of saying something that could be very unpleasant or offensive, okay? And then you think about tribute. You know, think about your history lessons, right? What was a tribute? It was something paid from a ruler or a country to another one in acknowledgement of superiority and protection. You think about that, a tribute. And think about everything you've learned about history and tribute. Of course, you know, tribute, we could also use that word in a different way. It's a sense of showing respect, gratitude, or affection. But I don't think I would need to put euphemistically in front of that tribute, because that second tribute is more of a willing, right? But either way, it's rightfully owed to the person getting the tribute. And who gets to dictate the amount of the tribute, the quality of the tribute? And when you look at history, it's the person accepting the tribute. I don't get to decide as a person that's being subjugated or submissive what tribute I'm going to give to you. It doesn't work that way. And also, tribute paid was not negotiable, right? We can look at what happens in the Kings and the Chronicles when the kings decide to rebel against Nebuchadnezzar or the Assyrians. It does not go well for them at all. So what we have here is this offering in Genesis. This is what is owed to God. It is rightfully his, and he gets to decide what it will be. And you look at it, and you're like, well, why did Cain and Abel give this offering to God? And we take what we just learned, it's because they're subject to him. So get this in your mind, giving is showing that you are subject to God. All right. And then we talk about an acknowledgement of submission. So we've covered the submission. Well, what about the protection? Okay. Remember, this is still, you know, the beginning of the world. Hopefully, there isn't that much to be physically protected from. But what about your sins? What about the consequences of their sins? Without God's protection, I would reap the consequences of my sins. And that's what we see here. Cain and Abel were admitting their submission to God and their need for protection from the consequences of their sins. And, you know, without that, you die in your sins. And we all know what happens in the afterlife when I die in my sins. But something went wrong. We know that. Something went very wrong. Somebody didn't pay attention to the tribute qualifications. And when we look in verse 7, it says, if thou doest well, and this is God speaking to Cain, shalt thou not be accepted? And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door, and unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him. We see this type of tribute, this offering, is some type of sin offering, which we'll learn later is It's not optional. It is not optional. It's meant to atone for your sins against God. And we don't know why Cain decided I didn't need to bring this. But we do know how it's later on described, even in the New Testament. Let's go to 1 John 3:12. First John chapter 3 and verse 12. Not as Cain, who was of that wicked one, and slew his brother. And wherefore slew he him? Because his own works were evil, and his brother's righteous. So, why did Cain slay his brother? Because his works were evil. It means his offering was evil. We look at Malachi chapter 1 and verse 8. Malachi chapter 1 and verse 8. It says, "And if ye offer the blind for sacrifice, is it not evil? And if ye offer the lame and sick, is it not evil? Offer it now unto thy governor. Will he be pleased with thee, or accept thy person? Saith the Lord of hosts." So, in Malachi, remember, the Israelites have come back from captivity. They are no longer doing idol worship, but their tribute to God is not what he has commanded and how it is described. It is described as evil. It's like, look, you are giving this to me, and you wouldn't even give this to the earthly governor that is over you. How would you feel if that was switched? You think more of this earthly man who does not love you, does not care if anything harms you, and you're giving this to me. It's the wrong tribute. And then you have to ask yourself, if it's the wrong tribute, is it even considered a tribute anymore? Is it even an offering anymore? Is it even giving anymore? And obviously, in God's eyes, it can't. Right here, he calls it evil. It's no longer a tribute when it's the wrong one. All right? So, things we learn from Cain. You don't get to dictate to God the type of offering or the tribute. When he has said, bring this, this is what you bring. And my attitude, as we see in Cain's, that it was not, has to be one of submission when I bring my offering. Okay? All right. Now we're going to fast forward a little bit. Genesis 14. Genesis chapter 14. And I like this. I was in the military. So this, I mean, I understand what's going on here. All right. I get it. We have Lot and his family at this time are living in Sodom. And this is what one of the things that happens while they're living in Sodom. So we're going to start Genesis chapter 14, verses 8 through 16. And there went out the king of Sodom, and the king of Gomorrah, and the king of Admah, and the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, the same is Zoar. And they joined battle with them in the vale of Siddim. So we have five kings here. With Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam, and with Tidal, king of nations, and Amphrel, king of Shinar, and Arok, king of Elasar, four kings with five. So we have the five kings that are rebelling and no longer paying tribute against the four kings that they owe the tribute to. All right? And the vale of Siddim was full of slime pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell there, and they that remained fled to the mountain. And they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their victuals and went their way. And they took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. And there came one that had escaped, and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt in the plain of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol, and brother of Aner, and these were confederate with Abram. And when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his trained servants, born in his own house, 318, and pursued them unto Dan. And he divided himself against them, he and his servants, by night, and smote them, and pursued them unto Hobah, which is in the left hand of Damascus. And he brought back all the goods, and also brought again his brother Lot, and his goods, and the women also, and the people. So, we see what happens when we don't bring the right tribute. Things don't go well. Things don't go well for these five kings. And it not only affects them, but it affects those around them. So Lot is taken. He's taken as plunder in the battle. Someone escapes and goes and tells Abram. And it's very interesting to me. This is who they go and seek. They go and find Abram. He tells Abram. He rallies the troops. He has some confederates with him, Mamre, Amorite, and Eshcol. They pursue, and they save all the goods. I mean, and we're not just talking about from Sodom in here. These four kings have been running roughshod through the entire country. And back then, that was sometimes your job. That's all you did. You went to war because you knew the payoff was plunder. These guys are professionals. But what happens? Abram and his confederates, his 318 men, are able to bring everything back. If anybody understands war, that is exceptional. That is amazing. That never happens. Somebody dies and things are lost, but Abram is able to bring it all back. All right, let's continue. Genesis 17 through 20. And the king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from the slaughter of Chedorlaomer and of the kings that were with him at the valley of Sheba, which is the king's dale. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be the Most High God, which hath delivered thine enemies into thy hand." And he gave him tithes of all. The kings that had fled, you know how it is. When all the hard work is done, somebody shows up. They have come to meet Abram. But who else do we have? We have Melchizedek. I mean, you think about this guy. He is one of the most powerful figures in the Bible who we almost know the least amount. But he is so important to everything. So Melchizedek comes and meets Abram. He is the king of Salem, which is later the city of Jerusalem. And he is the priest of the Most High God. And what does Abram give him? He gave him tithes of all, everything. The Hebrew tithes is meheser. You guys want me to spell that for you? I don't know. All right. Meaning the tenth part. And every time you see tithe in the Old Testament, it's this word, except for three places. All right? And that's aser. So it's very similar. And that means to give or take a tenth. So any way you look at it, 10% is involved. That's what it means to tithe. So Abram gives Melchizedek 10% of everything. And verse 20, it says, tithes of all. And I want you to think about this for a second. And Mr. Carl, who did a wonderful job at family camp in October, that's a shameless plug-in for later, all right? He did a great job talking about how the Bible is so clinical, meaning it tells you the facts without a lot of the drama, right? But think about this. How tedious and time-consuming this would be. You have to think. They took clothing. They took precious metals. They took livestock. Who knows what they took? Anything that you could carry, they took it. And now Abram is going to give him 10% of all of it. And imagine this, though. These men have already engaged in battle. Not only did they engage in battle, they continued and followed with that battle. They've got to bring all of it back, and now they got to sort it all out. So I'm thinking in my head, well, how are they going to do that? In Robin's brain, this is what would have happened. All right, we would have put nice, neat little piles everywhere of all the separate stuff. All right, clothes over here, gold over here, silver over there, livestock over there, and we all know how accommodating livestock can be. All right, and he takes all of that, and he gives it to Melchizedek. It takes effort. It takes time. It takes energy to do all of that. But they did it. And he was willing to do that to worship God. Abram understood giving is worshiping God. So let's continue. We're not done. Verse 21 through 24. And the king of Sodom said unto Abram, give me the persons and take the goods to thyself. And Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have lift up mine hand unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take from a thread even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abram rich, save only that which the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men which went with me, Aner, Eskel, and Mamre, let them take their portion. So now we continue, right? The king of Sodom says, you know, you keep the goods, whatever material things you got back, I'll take the people. Which, on the surface, looks like a very generous offer. But let's not forget who we're dealing with here. This is the king of Sodom, whose city will be destroyed for its immorality, its wickedness. From what I've read of the traditions of the Arabs, if you pursued and you got back the goods, you got to keep the goods. So Abram has pursued, he has defeated them, he's brought back the goods, he is entitled to the goods. Rightfully, they are his. The people are given back to whom they belong. So it's not like King of Sodom is being generous here. He's just reminding Abram of the tradition. Because remember, Abram was able to do what these four kings were not. I'm sorry, five. Abram and his band were able to defeat the four kings. Sodom was not able to with his allies. So it's not like the king of Sodom can forcefully take this from Abram. He's just, you know, politely reminding him, hey, man, just so you remember, this is how we usually do it around here. Okay? He's not being nice. Sodom's not being nice, all right? Because then it also begs the question later on, and some people will be like, well, what right does Abram have to give 10% of all that he has brought back? Well, this is why he has that right. I never thought about that before. He didn't ask the king of Sodom if he could. He just gave it. And in our world, that would be like, well, that wasn't yours to give. But it was. It was his to give. And so we see that he wasn't stealing from anyone. He was well within his rights to do this. But what does Abram say? What does he say? He says in 22, I have lift up mine hand unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take from a thread, even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abram rich. Like, dude, I'm giving you everything back, down to the shoelace. Why? Why did he do that? You think about this. Man, when I think about all of that, Abram did not want the king of Sodom to have any part in his blessings. He didn't want the king of Sodom to come back and say, you know, I'm the one who made Abram rich, not his God. I'm the one responsible for that. Abram's like, nope, you're not going to get any credit for this. I'm going to give it all away. I'm going to give it back to him. I'm going to give it back to whomever it belongs in these cities so that you won't be able to tell other people that my God cannot provide for me. And that is part of giving too, isn't it? It's an admitting that God provides for me. So there's no way he's going to let the king have any part of that. And you look at this promise that he made to God before he goes out on this expedition. He already had this mindset before he even left. He already knew what he was going to do with this before he even left. He is preparing before he even goes on this expedition. So, what do we learn from Abram? It's going to take some effort to give to God. You might have to get dirty for it. Maybe sweaty. I don't know. All right? And however you're material blessed, and obviously we are talking about legitimate and legal ways. Okay? I just want to make that disclaimer there. You need to give back to God. Right? And realize that all we have belongs to God anyway. I like how Melchizedek and Abram said, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth. Trust in him. He owns it all anyway. It's all his. He's God. He will be able to provide for you. All right, let's continue. Genesis 28. I feel like I should be asking you questions. Like, anybody have a question here? Raise your hand. We don't have time. All right, Genesis 28. In Genesis 28, we have Jacob leaving his family, a.k.a. running away. Let's just say what it is. He's running away here. And he rests during his journey, and he dreams. All right, we're going to go to Genesis chapter 12, verse 22, 12 through 22. And he dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham, thy father, and the God of Isaac. The land whereon thou liest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed. And thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and thou shalt spread abroad to the west, and to the east, and to the north, and to the south. And in thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And behold, I am with thee, and will keep thee in all places whither thou goest, and will bring thee again into this land. For I will not leave thee until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of. And Jacob awaked out of his sleep, and he said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not. And he was afraid, and said, how dreadful is this place! This is none other but the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. And Jacob rose up early in the morning and took the stone that he had put for his pillows and set it up for a pillar and poured oil upon the top of it. And he called the name of that place Bethel. But the name of that city was called Luz at the first. And Jacob vowed a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. And this stone which I have set for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee. So, we see in this dream that God is giving assurances to Jacob. You think about it. Jacob has left everything he has known. It's not like today, where you have instant communication. You can call somebody on the phone. If you're lost, you can look it up on GPS. It is not like this. This man is alone. And obviously, he didn't leave with a whole lot because he's using a rock for a pillow. All right? I don't know about you, but that is not my choice to do. I travel with my pillow. All right? It doesn't care if I'm going over to somebody's house. I take my pillow. All right? We can see he doesn't have a whole lot. And he doesn't know if all of this is going to work out. Think about this. This could be an unmitigated disaster. He has just stolen his brother's blessing, using lies. We all know how God feels about lies. This could affect the journey and everything after. And we see it does somewhat when we get Leah and Rachel involved into it, right? Is he going to be able to find his uncle? If he does find his uncle, is he going to be welcomed? Is he going to be able to provide it for himself? Will he ever see his family again? Think about that. Never being able to see the people that you love again. He could end up a wanderer for the rest of his life. But here we see God. God promises Jacob. He promises him. He promises that I will bring you back into the land. I will give it to you. Think about it. You are all alone. in the middle of the night. Remember, it's dark. There's no electricity. You go to bed and you see this great light. You see these angels coming up and down. And God gives you these promises. I don't know about you, but I would definitely be assured. I would be so grateful. There is somebody watching out for me and that loves me and is going to make sure I'm going to make it. And I'm going to be okay. And what is his reaction to these promises? Well, he worships God. In verse 22, he pours oil on the pillar. In verse 22, he says, "And this stone, which I have set for a pillar, shall be God's house. And of all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee." Jacob says he's going to give a tenth of everything that God is going to bless him with, right? And sometimes, and this is so annoying, it is annoying, some people get verse 20 confused. And I'm sure you've heard it before. It goes like this. This is what people think Jacob's saying. "If you come through for me like you said you would, then and only after I get what you say I'm going to get, then I will give you a tenth." Like Jacob is making a deal or he's bargaining with God. That's not what's happening here. Better way of saying it is, since God is going to be with me, he's going to take care of me, he's going to feed me, he's going to clothe me, he's going to make sure I get back to my family, I will return. Remember, when you use the word return, it means somebody gave it to you first. It's not yours. I will return 10% of everything that God gives me. So he acknowledges where his future provisions are coming from, right? But he also is very specific about what he will return. And you think about that. You know, some people might be a little more cautious about that. "Well, I'm not sure what I'm going to get here, so I don't know if I should commit myself to that." He's not hedging his bets. He's not waiting to see what he's going to get. He's not vague. He's convicted himself already before he has been given anything. And I don't think in our society we understand or appreciate exactly what a vow means. It is binding for the rest of your life. And if Jacob decides later, "You know what? I don't feel like God blessed me like he said he was going to bless me," it doesn't matter. He is bound to this. Annabelle is my youngest. She is the philosopher of the family. She's like, "Mommy, why will you be cursed if you don't honor your vow?" Well, because the consequences of not honoring your vow will curse you itself. You think about that? I promised you I would go and do this for you. I don't fulfill that promise. Now you have doubt in your mind about whether I will do anything I say. And, you know, there's other promises that you make. Men and women faithful in their vows, their marriage vows. You break those marriage vows. It is a consequence that will not only follow your whole life, but your children's life. Jacob has vowed. He understands exactly how specific it is. He didn't say this flippantly. He was not vague about it. He meant it. You can't take it back. So what do we learn from Jacob? Well, we've learned that we must return to God some portion of what he has blessed us with. That is only being grateful, right? And we need to be specific. Being specific helps focus our actions, right? Everybody knows at the first of the year, everybody gets a gym membership, right? Everybody gets that gym membership. I'm going to go to the gym. Woohoo! Good for you. All right, now, how long does that last? Not long. Let's just be honest. Maybe a week or two. However, if I say, "You know what? I'm going to go to the gym on this day at this time. And when I go to the gym, this is what I'm going to work on." It's a bit different, isn't it? I'm like, okay, I'm more focused. Like, I know this time I have set aside and I'm going to be there and I'm going to rearrange my schedule to be around this time. And when I get there, I'm not going to wonder what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to do. You see how that works? Man, when I'm specific, the likelihood of me actually performing that action is much greater. And we see that in Jacob. All right. Now, obviously, we're just in the book of Genesis. We haven't, all right, besides 1 John and Malachi, we have stayed in the book of Genesis. We haven't even gone to the other half of it yet. So, and we don't have a lot of time here. So now we're going to go to the Mosaical period. The law of Moses, and we know this starts around Exodus and goes all the way to Jesus dying on the cross. All right, and we talked about being specific with Jacob, but when we get to the law of Moses and we get to giving, we get really specific. And sometimes we don't like being specific because it's not fun, all right? I can't use my imagination. I can't be spontaneous. I can't do what I want to do, okay? But the thing, and I tell this to the girls all the time, there's a pro and con to each one. Being specific, when I perform the task, there's no doubt in my mind whether or not I did it correctly. I know God said to do this, this, and this, and I did it, and I know that it's pleasing to him. So I have that in my mind, and when the Israelites and later the Jews do this, they can be assured that what they have done is acceptable and, as we will see, a sweet aroma to God. So, and I tell you what, I waited forever to do this part because I didn't want to do this part because I am so glad I am a New Testament Christian and that yoke is easy and that burden is light because, well, and we're not even going to be able to talk about it all because we don't have time. The first one we're going to talk about, though, is tithes because Priscilla told me that's what I had to do. All right? Tithes means, and we already talked about a tenth. It is 10%. And I'm just going to give you the verses for this. We don't have time to actually read them all. So the first tithe, there's three of them. The first tithe is the priestly tithe. It's in Leviticus 27, 30 through 33. And also Numbers 18, 21 through 24. It is 10% of the flock or the crop. It was used to supply the Levites, and in turn the Levites gave 10% to the priests. Did I get that right? Anybody else have any other information? Let me know. Okay. All right. The second was the festival type tithe. It was in Deuteronomy 14, 22 through 23. It was of the increase of the Lord. So it was the grain left over after the seed grain was accounted for. Because you know, when you go harvest your crop, the majority of it is used to sell again. But you must keep a portion of that back to be able to get your seed to sow for next year. So from that, you took the leftover seed grain, and that is what you used as your tithe. Now, the thing about this tithe is that it had to be brought to Jerusalem. You shared it again with the Levites, and it was eaten there by the household. This is called the mandatory vacation because you had to take it to Jerusalem. All right, this third is the poor tithe. It's in Deuteronomy 14, 28 through 29. This one was every 3 years, and this was to be shared with the Levites, but also the stranger, the widow, and the poor. This tithe was not taken to Jerusalem. It was used in their local area at their city. So you have these three tithes. Now, when you look at all these, every one of them had in common one thing. They were used for the Levites and the priesthood. Obviously, these also helped other people, though. This helped the poor, the widows, the orphans. And that's the interesting thing about the tithe and what brought it all together. And then I asked myself, well, what happens when you don't provide this tithe? What happens to your priesthood when they're no longer supplied with this? Let's go to Nehemiah chapter 13, verses 10 and 11. All right. Nehemiah chapter 13, verses 10 through 11. And I perceived that the portions of the Levites had not been given them, for the Levites and the singers that did the work were fled everyone to his field. Then contended I with the rulers and said, "Why is the house of God forsaken?" And I gathered them together and set them in their place. We have Nehemiah. We all know what happens in Nehemiah. The wall is built. Not only has the wall been built, the temple procedures are reestablished again, and Nehemiah returns to King Artaxerxes. But while he is gone, things go by the wayside. This is another one you could go, like, the importance of leadership. But while Nehemiah is gone, what happens while he's gone? Well, you look in verses 4 through 12, well, I'm sorry, 4 through 9, you have a man that we all know by the name of Tobiah. They make him a room where the gathering of these tithes are supposed to be so that he can live in it. And so the tithes are not being gathered, they're not being distributed. And what happens in verse 11? The house of God is forsaken. Right? They were not giving in worship like they were supposed to. And what is the result? The commands of God are not upheld. Right? God has plans for your giving. Your giving matters. When you give to God in worship, think about that. It matters. Okay. What time am I supposed to stop? Like, nah, I'm supposed to stop now. All right. Offerings. Because I spent so much time on it, we're going to do it. And you have to listen to it. All right. Offerings. All right, you have burnt offering, meat, meal, or grain offering, peace offering, sin offering, trespass offering, wave offering, heave offering, drink offering, free will offering, jealousy offering. And according to the Jewish Encyclopedia, I do not have all of them. Okay? And Sheena, I'm sure, is going to hit on some of these, maybe. I don't know. All right. Burnt offering, it's all of the offerings, that I'm talking about are mostly in about the seven first chapters of Leviticus. Okay? So, burnt offerings. Leviticus 1, 3 through 17, it represented complete surrender to God. This, and you think of the burnt offering, you know, you do have the burnt offering that you're supposed to give in the morning and the evening, but that was for the entire people of Israel. This was one that you brought yourself. It was voluntary. And it was a sweet savor to the Lord. The wonderful thing about this one was that depending on your income, you didn't have to bring one type of offering. It ranged from a male sheep all the way down to pigeons. Okay, the meat or meal offering, also the grain offering, Leviticus 2, 1 through 16, represented thanksgiving to God. It too was voluntary and a sweet savor to the Lord. And it was in some form of wheat, barley, or oats. It could already be cooked, or it could be brought by itself, but it need to be accompanied with oil and frankincense. Peace offerings represented a right relationship and friendship with God, also represented thanksgiving to God. It too was voluntary and a sweet savor to the Lord. Sin offerings, trespass offerings, just what it sounds like. These were for sins. Either they were unintentional, they were sins against the Lord, against holy things, against neighbors. These were not voluntary. These were not a sweet savor to the Lord. Wave offering, and I thought this was hilarious, between the wave offering and the heave offering. So what you would do between the wave offering, the peace offering, heave offering, they were part of the peace offerings. What you would do for the wave offering is you take the breast of whatever animal you brought and you would just wave it across the altar. I am not joking. I'm like, it can't be that easy. All right, a wave offering, and it was set aside for the priests in general. The heave offering was the right shoulder of the animal being offered from the peace offering, and you heaved it up and down. That's where you get heave offering from. And that was given to the priest who actually sprinkled the blood from the offering. So that was his personally. Then you have drink offering. It was usually brought with the burnt and the peace offering. So with some of these offerings, you also brought. So with the peace and the burnt offering, you also brought the grain offering and a drink offering with it. And it dictated, the size dictated on how big of an offering you brought. Bigger the offering, the more drink offering you brought. Free will offerings, and I think we'll save that for next period. This had two types of free will offerings. The ones you see in Exodus 35 when they brought for the tabernacle. You know, the Israelite God, Moses says, all right, these are the materials we need for the tabernacle to be built. And they just bring it in droves. They bring so much of it, Moses has to say, okay, we need you guys to stop. The other is the free will offering we see in the Mosaical. It was brought three times. Again, this was mandatory. You did it for Passover, Pentecost, and the Feast of Tabernacles. The great thing about this is it wasn't specified. The amount was not specified. You give as you have been richly blessed, and then you'll return the offering. Jealousy offering, that was Numbers 5, 15 through 25. You can look that up on your own. I'm sure if you know what I'm talking about, you can look that up on your own. So what do we learn from the offerings? I'm glad I don't have to do it. Okay, you think about it. Hezekiah, did you get the ram out of the back pasture? Like, no. Did you cook the cakes? No, now we're going to have to pick up frankincense and oil on the way. I mean, think about it. This is specific, almost like, man. But each one taught them a specific thing about giving to God. One, God wants you to do it voluntary. Two, it's voluntary, but part of it is also mandatory. Right? You do need to give to God. I run out of time, but remember this. So much more, like everybody has said, there is so much more about giving that you can do on your own. We haven't even gone into history or poetry or into the prophets. And remember, so remember this, if you remember anything. We don't dictate the tribute. Trust him to provide for you when you give. You do need to return some portion of what God has blessed you with and be specific about it. And giving in worship to God is necessary to uphold his commands. And if you learn anything from the offerings, remember, this is a relationship not only with God, but with other men. This not only affected your relationship with God, but my helping provide for those around me. Okay? And that's all I have for there. Thank you.